From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The filmmaker Andrew Rossi says he's interested in institutions that are being disrupted by cultural forces and technology. Newspapers are one of these. His film Page One is about how papers are trying to survive in the digital era. His latest film is about higher education, another institution facing an uncertain way forward. The statistic at the heart of this film is this one. Student loan debt is at more than $1 trillion. So Rossi breaks that down, explains how we got here. His film asks whether a college education is really worth it anymore, and what is it we're asking of students these days, and is there a different model that could be more effective or efficient? Today in the program, Andrew Rossi will join us to talk about his film. It's called Ivory Tower. After the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Andrew Rossi's new documentary, we're reminded of the place college holds in our culture, not only the traditions themselves, but the values of education and access. But for all kinds of different reasons, the model that the system has used for hundreds of years really now is breaking down. It's being disrupted by the realities of a modern digital culture. This kind of disruption has always interested Rossi. His acclaimed film Page One explored how newspapers are coping with technology. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about this latest film. It's called Ivory Tower, which has premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. And it asks all of those big questions. Among them, of course, is a college education really worth it anymore? What are we asking of students? Is there a different model that could be more effective or could be more efficient? Andrew Rossi is joining us, as I said, and we'll give you details about the screenings of his film. He directed and co-produced Ivory Tower, which is screening later today in Park City. And there are a number of screenings, as I mentioned. You can go to our website for the particulars. And Andrew Rossi, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Doug. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to begin with that thing that I had mentioned about this idea of you being interested in how institutions, these big institutions like newspapers for Page One, are being disrupted by culture, by all these forces at play. What is it about that that interests you, do you think?
I'm not really sure, other than a sort of draw that I have to the conflict that emerges in that situation. Typically, certain institutions that seem invincible or impenetrable suddenly encounter an obstacle or a new path forward. And I think in that moment, people who are sort of trying to do a good job and have sort of aspirations to something that we all care about, realize that they just have to completely reorder themselves. And it's a sort of existential moment, mm-hmm. as well as an economic one and a social one.
Did you go out looking, once you finished Page One, did you think, oh, and let me find another institution that's being disrupted? I mean, were you going out looking for that?
I guess I was, in a sense. Huh. I mean, I'm always open to different ideas of films to do, but I was thinking I would love to be able to sink my teeth into something of a similar gravity to the culture and potential cinematic, I don't know, just sort of...
There's a lot of stories.
Drama, I guess it is. Yes.
Of course. That is the thing I have to say. It was interesting. I mean, because you have a couple of things going on in your film. One is you sort of, and we'll get through this as much as we can through the hour, but you sort of get us, there's a kind of historical part of this, and this is how, this is the role that college played, and this is the model, and all of those kinds of things. But then in the background, there are these personal stories that are playing out. Related to the question of access to education, related to the question of these different kinds of models. And I guess that's the idea, right, for filmmakers. If it's just a bunch of talking heads, it's not very interesting. You've got to find the actual people.
Absolutely. And we felt it was important to establish a philosophical framework for the viewer to understand education as something that has been perceived as a public good versus a private good in American history. And so there's a sort of a combination of verite stories, such as a freshman at Harvard who used to be homeless and now is at the school, and it's transformed his entire family and community as well as his own personal life. And there are stories of other professors and students. But then there's a sort of grounding in the trajectory of higher education in this country, starting with Harvard, the first university that was established in 1636 as a sort of outgrowth of the church. And then the government stepping in with the Morrill Act in the 1860s to establish the land-grant universities, FDR's New Deal creating the GI Bill, and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society creating the Higher Education Act of 1965, all of which were an attempt by this country's government and leading thinkers to create a system where people could have self-respect and could advance through class, through employment, and through knowledge to better themselves and better the country. And all of that sort of shifts, as we understand through Anya Kamenetz and Andrew DelBanco and others who appear in the film, who are leading sort of historians and thinkers about higher ed, in the 1970s, when conservative governors...
like Ronald Reagan.
Like Ronald Reagan, who then, when he campaigned to become the president of the United States, actually suggested to do away with the Department of Higher Education. They all sort of thought that, well, if you're getting a college degree and you're making more money, then you should pay for that.
Yeah. Because this is a private thing. If you're going to make private money off of this, why are we as the government contributing to this? But it was an ideal that we had in this country that education was a public thing. It was a public good up until that time. And then everything starts to shift. And do you see this as one of the principal things that started to kind of dismantle, if I can put it that way, where the system has ended up today?
I believe it is really the crucial factor or moment at which things really started to go wrong, because at that time, state funding for public colleges and universities declined, and
graduation rates, all of those
graduation rates also started to go down, and student loan debt rose up because the government was no longer providing Pell Grants in the same way that it had been. And this entire sort of student loan business industry grew up and basically provided the vehicle for federal subsidies or federal dollars to go to the schools.
Yeah.
And so the schools then had to raise tuition to get those student dollars.
Let's back up a little bit, because I want to start with sort of something conceptual. You kind of begin the film talking about, and you mentioned Andrew DelBanco. He's terrific, plays a terrific role in the piece. He's this professor of humanities at Columbia, thinks a lot about this stuff. And one of the things he explores, and you do in the film as well, is the role that colleges play in our culture. And DelBanco says something that's interesting. He says college is a way of preserving cultural memory. What's he getting at there?
I was really struck by that. And his book, College, What It Is, Was, and Should Be, has a really beautiful rendering of a sense of the university as a repository for knowledge in our culture, and a way to sort of humanity's way to battle against mortality.
Yeah.
It's this inexorable, continual, you know, passage of knowledge from older people to younger people. And as he says, the younger people keep on replenishing themselves on the campus.
And I just keep getting older, he says too.
Exactly.
Which is great.
Right. Which I think is something that we've found is striking from parents and other people who see the film. There's a certain nostalgia to it. They feel like they're going back to school, as you know, even though they're also learning some things that are sort of disturbing about the higher education sector. But I think DelBanco is crucial in establishing why should we care. This is not just about people acquiring skills to get jobs to make money. This is about society perpetuating everything it believes in for generations to come.
Anya Kamenetz, she plays another role in this film. I wanted to ask you about her, because one of the things she says is that for so long, higher education was this black box, is how she puts it. Something that we never really asked the difficult questions about. We never really scrutinized it. And I guess what she's saying now is all of those, everything's up for grabs in terms of higher ed.
That's absolutely right. So everything I just talked about what's so great about college, she says that now that moral authority that colleges and universities have has been challenged. And that you know, can be found in the sort of the meme or trend of Mark Zuckerberg having dropped out mm-hmm. of Harvard and people's mm-hmm. sort of cynicism about what is really derived from the conventional 4-year residential experience.
Yeah, look, he's a billionaire. He dropped out. Gates too.
Exactly. And of course, in the film, we address that idea and sort of debunk it, I think. But then there are, I think, really intelligent critiques about how to unbundle what college does. And so that's part of this getting at what's in the black box. What are you really getting when you put down your potentially $60,000 a year in college? And so one of the things that the film does is almost in a sort of consumer report kind of way, enumerate what those things are. You know, knowledge transfer, a network of peers, and credentialing or a diploma to certify you to go out into the world.
I wanted to, one of the things that you talk about is, as you mentioned, Andrew Del Banco talks about how the university, Harvard in particular, but some of these other colonial schools were like churches. They were passing down information. The idea is transforming you into a life of, how does he put it, purpose and meaning, which is interesting. And so Harvard, as you say, sort of gives us the model, really. This is the model that we're still, I think, looking to in some way, it might be said. And I want to ask you about Clayton Christensen. He's a figure that people know around here, of course, a Mormon, acclaimed a professor at Harvard Business School, and really one of the leading sort of thinkers in terms of disruption technology. He plays a part in your film. Talk a little bit about Clayton Christensen and what he's sort of getting at here.
Absolutely. Well, Clayton Christensen provides a sort of framework to think about how there is a sort of cost disease and a race for prestige in the higher education sector. And the way that he explains that is by positioning Harvard as the sort of foundation for the DNA of higher ed, which is actually a sort of benevolent problem in the sense that Harvard, with its very large endowment, is able to continually build better research facilities and laboratories, dormitories, nicer cafeterias, stadiums, things of that nature. And it has sort of crystallized the model for a 4-year residential path in college that everyone else is racing to copy and or emulate so that they can do as good a job as they perceive Harvard to be doing, but also to get the prestige that allows them to charge a lot and to draw more students. So the problem here is that not every school has the multi-billion dollar endowment that Harvard does. And so in order to pay for all that growth and services that really start to move away from the core mission of educating students.
Like rock climbing walls. And
like rock climbing walls, exactly.
Yeah, which is a symbol in the film, I think.
Absolutely. So instead of focusing on the core mission, they need to build these other things and go into debt themselves. Yeah. And just basically be charging the students more and more and more, and as he describes it, you know, higher education has been extremely successful for many, many years, but now things are changing because the cost and the scope of higher ed is so large and so massive that it's unsustainable.
He says it's a tough game to keep playing.
Exactly. How can universities remain on this treadmill of trying to grow bigger and better all the time when they don't have the dollars themselves to support it? And who's going to be the entity or the person that's going to pay for it? It's going to be the student.
It's so interesting because there's this section in the film where you're talking about this. It's like perks wars, right? To find these perks. And you talk about the pools and the climbing walls I mentioned. the big screen TVs, these big student centers that have really great food and beautiful architecture, and it's referred to as this arms race. Grotesque, I think, is another word they use.
That's right. Andy DelBanco says at a certain point it can become grotesque. And of course, the other element that goes along with all that building are the managers and administrators that are required to manage that physical plant and, in addition, sort of satisfying various federal regulations and managing this mini city that the school has become.
Yeah.
And so we see that administrative personnel has grown by 230 or 240% since 1978, while faculty alone has grown by about 52% in that same time. So that's another sort of myth that we're trying to address. Many people think that, oh, you know, the reason why it's so expensive are these
professors. Yeah,
the professors, they're I mean, certainly their benefits, healthcare benefits, yes, those are expensive. But look at the personnel, even in some cases, the coaches on various athletic teams and the support staff for those operations. That's a really big driver.
You know, one thing that surprised me is how much of a – how relevant it is, this idea of school party – university party culture, which you kind of dismisses, you know, it's just – it's just funny, but I never realized how important the idea of party culture really played into the story.
It's really fascinating. It's true. There's such a sort of instinct to say, oh, well, people party in college and that's fine. The sort of Jim Belushi with, you know, in the middle of a food fight in Animal House wearing a T-shirt that says college. Like, that's what college means. But there's a very insidious structural problem with that, which we look at talking with Elizabeth Armstrong and her co-writer in a study called Paying for the Party, which basically shows how a lot of mid-tier large state universities have tried to attract out-of-state students who pay more and can thus offset the reduction in state funding by encouraging there to be a very robust social life. And for those out-of-state students, many of which are wealthy enough to come and pay much more,
which is often double,
absolutely, that can work. It's conceivable that they can sort of indulge this work hard, play hard culture. But for other students who can't afford to take the cab to the bar and buy all the drinks, and can't keep up with their work load, they often fail out. They are unable to complete in 4 years, and they spend more money on loans. And this party culture has a really insidious effect. So it's not just about, you know, doing keg stands and, oh, that's a fun part of social life. The sort of structural focus on encouraging party culture is leading to inequality.
What seems to have happened, and this is a theme I think that emerges in the film, is that they're not really students anymore. They're customers. And Richard Arum, he's another author that you – the interview has been exploring these issues for a long time. He talks about how the focus is being pushed away from the teachers are now having to kind of incentivize the students to stick around. And I wanted you to talk about this because you see that sort of rate my professors thing. And that's become such an important thing that since they're customers, as opposed to providing this kind of rigorous experience, professors are having to kind of make friends with the students in a different kind of way, and it seems to be changing the experience.
That's right. I think Jeff Salingo in his book College Unbound describes a classroom as a sort of theater of favors.
Right.
That everyone is doing favors for each other so that they mutually reinforce their ratings on social media, or as you said, the Rate My Professor website. And so this is all part of another bigger structural problem, which Richard Arum in his book Academically Adrift has really shed amazing light on. He's basically shown that 36% of students graduate after their 4 years in college without any appreciable increase in skills, and not basically having learned anything. And he has a lot of interesting statistics on the lack of reading that's done, the lack of writing that's done, and it's really disturbing. But it ties into this notion that the student who is arriving on campus and paying so much money does not perceive themselves as somebody that's supposed to engage in a very rigorous course of study and sort of suffer through through the ladder of knowledge, but rather is a consumer and should be able to indulge in a menu of fun and entertaining products, including the academic experience.
And 68%, you mentioned in the film, of students at public universities, they fail to graduate in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
That seems startling.
I was shocked when I saw that number. I really was. And in fact, then, you know, we go on to look at the Cal State system, and Governor Jerry Brown explains that 84% of students in the Cal State system fail to graduate in 4 years. So I didn't want to make a sort of doomsday movie, but there really are things about higher education and its future that are outrageous and that are shocking. And the culture, the society as at large needs to have a conversation about how we address this.
Andrew Rossi is with us. He directed and co-produced the documentary film Ivory Tower, which is screening today at 5:30 at the Prospector Square Theater in Park City, again on Saturday at the Egyptian Theater. For all those details, you can visit us at radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are back at community radio station KPCW. We're profiling another documentary at Sundance this year. It's Andrew Rossi's new film that explores the challenges facing higher education. As we've been talking about, Rossi's interested in institutions that are being disrupted by cultural forces and technology. We mentioned his film Page One, which premiered at Sundance in 2011. That examined newspapers. This latest is driven by that statistic that student loan debt is more than $1 trillion. It asks the big questions, among them, of course, is a college education really worth it anymore? Andrew Rossi's joining us here in the studio. And I wanted to ask you about one of the questions that comes up is different models, different people that are trying to sort of stay the course, I guess. And one of them is the experience at Deep Springs College, which you talk about. Let's talk a little bit about that. One of the things that's interesting to note about that, and I think people in the West around here know Deep Springs College. This is in Death Valley in California, basically, and it's this really intriguing institution. And it's free.
That's right. It was established by Sam L. Nunn, I believe in 1919 or 1921, to be a school in which students share in the governance of the institution, only about 21 of them at any given time. And they pursue three pillars. One is this idea of self-governance, the other is labor, and the other is intense academic study.
Yeah.
And so it's the complete opposite of the experience that the sort of students as consumers are experiencing. Because here at Deep Springs, we see the students milking cows, working on the ranch, cleaning toilets themselves, deciding what classes to take, being extremely invested in their own education. And as one of the professors says to one of the students, basically being accountable for their own education, not expecting the institution to provide everything to them.
Andrew Delbenko talks about how college is this rehearsal for democracy. He talks about, I guess, the experience of colleges like Deep Springs. This idea that it's more than just the experience is holistic, I guess. It's supposed to take into account all of these different elements of the human character.
Absolutely. And this notion of democracy, you know, it stems originally from Thomas Jefferson's conception that in order for the citizenry to be able to spot a demagogue and not just listen to what a politician might say, they need to be able to sort of truth squad what people are telling them. And so they need to have the ability to debate and to decipher the truth in what's being delivered to them. And that's part of the process that we see unfold in the seminar rooms of Deep Springs. We see students debating each other and
teachers too.
And teachers too, absolutely. And I think that's sort of civility, that ability to come into a room with one opinion and leave with another and hash things out. That's part of the democratic spirit of education.
You also, there's a nice section in the film where you talk about, you mentioned the sort of the emergence of like the land grant colleges, but also the historically black colleges. And you, there's a bit about Spelman College. Talk a little bit about where that plays.
So I think that's really one of like my favorite parts of the movie, just because, you know, again, to go back to this idea of college as a place of character formation, of self-discovery, we see the students at Spelman College, which is a historically black all-women's college, talking about their experience at Spelman, being able to debate race and gender, and also seeing an environment of educated black women who are achieving and how much confidence that builds for them. And so Brooke Brewster, who's one of the students, we see her actually traveling to the inauguration with some of her classmates and watching President Obama being inaugurated. And she compares that experience of seeing the first lady and the first family, which look like her and talk like her, making her feel like she can go out into the world and accomplish something. And she says that's just what the historically black college is like for her too.
There's an important sort of plot point in the film related to this college called Cooper Union. And before we talk about the particulars of it, I'm wondering when did at what point in the film did you learn about Cooper Union and the tumult that was going on there?
Absolutely. So we started shooting in August, September of 2012.
Yeah.
And we were at Harvard first, then we moved to UVA and San Jose State. We were in April of 2013 filming UnCollege in San Francisco when on the front page of the New York Times, there was an article saying that Cooper Union, which is a college in New York City that educates just about 1,000 students, but has been one of the free schools for 150 years, was going to start charging.
Yeah.
And that an era was ending. And it had sort of been on my radar that Cooper Union was having difficulties. Mm-hmm. But this came as really a surprise. And immediately we understood that the struggle of Cooper Union was sort of the apotheosis of this entire problem.
Yeah, it's the metaphor in the film, right?
It is the metaphor. It is the climax of all these problems.
You know, it's interesting. We should say that it's, as you said, the mission statement, which the students keep referring to in these student protests, the mission statement is this: a full scholarship for every enrolled student. This is a free education, and so there's this tension that builds. And what's interesting about it is the president, Jamshed Barucha. Did I get that right?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, good. Jamshed Barucha. He's the president. He becomes president in 2011, and of course he is having to deal with the endowment is not paying for, because they get into massive debt by building this extraordinary building. It's beautiful, but it was incredibly costly, like $150 million, something like that. So they get into massive debt. And now they're faced with this idea that they're no longer able to keep up with this central ideal of their institution, which is a free education, that they're going to have to start considering tuition. And Jamshed Barucha, the new president in 2011, he's the guy that's got to deal with it. Let me play a clip from the film. This is Jamshed Barucha, the president. But we also hear a student. I mean, it's this give and take in this part of the film with the students and with the president. Victoria Sobel, we also hear about her. And you get a sense I want you to set this up for us a little bit. The students who are idealistic, they have this idea that education is noble and should be free. And then you've got this, in some ways, I have to say, I feel sorry for the guy, this president, who's having to deal with these difficult realities. Talk a little bit about that, and we can play a little clip from the film.
For sure. Well, so Peter Cooper established Cooper Union with an endowment, which actually includes the land under the Chrysler Building, which is extremely valuable, and has sustained Cooper Union for the last 150 years through two world wars, through the Great Depression, to remain free for the students who go there. And that is not just a sort of administrative quirk. It's part of the mission of the school. It's part of its identity. And so in the year 2006, they took out a loan of $175 million to build a new building. And one of the reasons why the movie is called Ivory Tower is because it's a metaphor for the constant building and corporate expansion of these universities. And this building is the ultimate ivory tower. It took $1,000 per square foot to build. It contains Byzantine stairs and many floors, and it is just too expensive for this institution that's supposed to be free. And unfortunately, it has been the undoing of the school, because to pay for it, they have to spend $10 million a year on mortgage payments, and they just can't handle it.
Yeah. Here's a clip from the film, Ivory Tower.
Being free, the financial model is extremely complicated. You know, you look at the financial statements and you can see an extraordinarily large deficit. I think Peter Cooper would have wanted us, if we had to talk about tuition, to be able to talk about it.
We all acknowledge that we're in a financial strait right now, but the administration and the board fail to understand how tuition is going to destroy the school. What we're doing now is really giving our time and our energy to focus on how we can make this, once again, the progressive and radical beacon that it really should be, and the way that Peter Cooper envisioned it.
The administration must publicly affirm
the colleges.
They're talking, I mean, they're intense here, and we should mention that a crucial point in the film is that they actually go, and we see this in the film, and occupy the president's office.
That's right. They occupy the president's office for 65 days, which I'm not certain, but many say is the longest student occupation in American history. And it's really a remarkable example, again, not only of this financial model of higher education failing, but also of the resilience and the passion of students to organize to try and do something about that. I think the students of Cooper Union really showed a remarkable endurance and I think maturity in their actions. And they succeeded in at least delaying the implementation of tuition. But as we saw just last week, on January 10th, the board considered the proposals that a working group submitted and decided to go ahead and charge tuition.
I want to ask about a particular scene that I found remarkable. They've occupied the president's office, and the president, to his credit, he decides he's going to come and sit with them and talk to them, which was looked awkward and uncomfortable for him. And there's a moment in the film, I want to play another clip here. The various students are sort of confronting the president, and then an alumni trustee steps in to sort of defend the president. And then there's a remarkable kind of speech by this student. Say a little something about that, because I want to play this scene.
So Bob Dennison, I believe his name is, he's an architecture student at the school. And when the students were occupying the president's office, as you explained, Jamshin Baruka comes in to have some sort of rapprochement or conversation with them. And it quickly devolves into a sort of shouting match. And Bob stands up and he gives this speech that just, I mean, the poise that he has as a 20-something student is incredible. And he really just like encapsulates all the issues that are at stake.
An entire school does not have any confidence in your ability to leave the Cooper Union. If people have no confidence, it means that no, you're not going to be able to regain that trust, because there's none left.
You know, it's a little simplistic to say that, you know, you don't do this and you don't do that. I'm on the board. I was firmly for no tuition. The numbers are what they are. However they got there, that's where they are now.
No.
Can I finish?
Listen, excuse me.
You need to go.
I would like the tone of this whole discussion to cool down a little bit. It's pretty clear, I think, to all of us that this moment is different than anything that's come before. We haven't been to this point, all right? And I think we need to let go of some of the old dialogue because we're in a new place right now. What we need to do, quite simply, is realize this moment in the country with $1 trillion in student debt, with all the models of higher education as a business, it's failing. This is a moment for this school to be the vision of what education can be in this country, just as it was the vision 150 years ago. It was part of a radical capitalist vision. It is rooted in a turn of century idea about humanity. And it's an idea that I think is incredibly contemporary and incredibly urgent, all right? To effectively lead us, you need to realize the moment you're in and the position you're in. It is a historic position. It is a historic moment. This is a big step that you came here to meet with us. But we need a leap, not a gamble.
You know what I love about it is, on one hand, it seems kind of naive, you know? Yes, it's noble and all of these kinds of things, but how are we going to pay $10 million for the deficit every year? Like, that was part of one impulse I was thinking about. But then the other part was, man, if anyone could do it, these guys could. You know, the sense of possibility with these young people, and you see that throughout the film, it seemed like a theme in some way that maybe they can figure this out.
Right. I mean, I have to say, you know, with respect, the idea that it's naive that they should continue to be free, I don't totally agree with, because I think that if they start to charge tuition, I think the proposed number is about $20,000, and there are 1,000 students. Mm-hmm. Let's say they make $2 million from doing that. That still doesn't cover the $10 million. And I think that because this is so much a part of their identity and their mission, it's not that they're trying to switch to that model now. They're trying to stay as they have always been. And it's just too easy for everyone in today's culture to think that something that's free is absurd. And of course, we hear Milton Friedman in the movie basically saying that, and even Mayor Bloomberg at their graduation saying nothing is free.
Right.
And I think it's really difficult for people to sort of transcend that mentality. But I think that with Cooper Union, because it's this crucial part of their mission, it's not necessarily naive to think that they should figure out another way to continue that. You know, do a sale leaseback of the building, or sell it completely. Just make cuts and make things smaller, streamline their operation. I think that would be a better course for them than charging tuition.
Andrew Rossi is with us. He directed and co-produced the documentary film Ivory Tower, which is in the documentary category at this year's Sundance Film Festival, screening today at 5:30 at Prospector Square Theater in Park City. Also on Saturday at the Egyptian Theater here in Park City. For all the details, go to radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the filmmaker Andrew Rossi. We're talking about his latest film, Ivory Tower, which is premiered in the documentary category here at the Sundance Film Festival. We'll give you details about some of the screenings as we go along. It talks about some of the challenges facing higher education. So one of the things that comes up is some of these disruption models. You know, people are figuring a way out of all of this. And I wanted to ask you about Peter Thiel. He's another character here. He's one who says, let's do something else. Talk about Peter Thiel.
So Peter Thiel has been one of the major sort of forces driving this question of whether college is worth it, because he is an entrepreneur who made a considerable amount of money running and starting PayPal, and has in his philanthropic endeavors decided to establish something called 20 Under 20, or 2420, which is basically a fellowship that gives people $100,000 to drop out of school and to pursue an entrepreneurial idea. And there's a lot of there's a lot to Peter Thiel's sort of argument that makes sense. He's one of the people who says that college has been sold and oversold for many years, but we don't really understand what people are learning in many cases, and we need to rethink this. He also compares the student loan bubble, as he calls it, to the mortgage crisis mm-hmm. and to the internet bubble. And I think in one instance that I do agree with, says that challenging higher education is like challenging the existence of Santa Claus. And I do think that sort of holiness surrounding the sector is not productive to debate. However, as we see in the film, his solution of giving people $100,000 is not going to work for everyone. Yeah. And particularly for disadvantaged students, he admits that he doesn't have a solution and that that's a bigger question.
I think that's a powerful moment in the film, I have to say. He's like, everyone can do this. At first you get the sense that, hey, you know, and, you know, drop out, skip college, hack your education. This is a whole theme in the film. This idea of un-college and hacker houses. And then you start to realize as that section in the film develops that these aren't just any kids. Some of them come from privilege. They have extraordinary levels of intelligence, access to resources that most people don't. And Peter Thiel does sort of concede that, yeah, this probably isn't for everyone. And that's a big point in the film.
It's not a scalable model.
Yeah.
However, MOOCs, which are massive open online courses, have been the dream of a solution that could scale. And of course, we go into that, and it's not an easy answer either.
No, let's talk about that. MOOCs, because this is a big controversy, of course, in the field, whether or not MOOCs essentially the idea of massive open online courses, you know, whether or not we should have access. Everyone should have access to these courses and let people learn as in an open source environment. Another player in this story becomes Sebastian Thrun, who is with Stanford for a time, and he quits and sort of creates a private sector company called Udacity that he essentially sells to California. This is really interesting. Talk a little bit about Sebastian Thrun.
Sure. So Sebastian runs Udacity, which, like Coursera and edX on the East Coast, which is an outgrowth of Harvard and MIT, provide sort of packages of classes that contain videotaped lectures or instruction and quizzes and social media, basically ways for students to interact with each other in taking a class in a virtual context. A lot of these have been very successful in enrolling hundreds of thousands of students. Of course, the number that actually complete the class is much lower. But even that, in the context of people who already have an education or want to switch careers or want to get a promotion, is okay. It's okay that many people are browsing and not finishing. When it becomes problematic is when Udacity partners with San Jose State University to offer a pilot to what are known as remedial students, basically students who come into college not having basic algebra and other mathematical skills that they should have gotten in high school. And so Governor Brown, who has, I think, a very positive goal of trying to create more access to classes to address those remedial needs, decides that maybe Udacity and Sebastian can provide a MOOC to teach college algebra and other mathematics classes.
And it's an interesting story because you see the people, not everyone at San Jose is on board with this. One professor, Rita Manning, well, a number of them, I'm sure there, are not crazy about the idea that we're licensing our education with this startup. And I think she mentioned she wouldn't use a startup to renovate her house or fix her bathroom or something like that.
That's exactly right.
I mean,
yes.
A real kind of skepticism about whether or not this is going to work. And so it's pretty controversial, but But they go for it. And I don't want to give too much away, but it is interesting, the results, because they don't seem to work all that well.
That's right. And this, you know, this is public knowledge, and it's part of this ongoing debate. This is a living, breathing question. So there are not resolute answers, but there are clear data points now. So that initial Udacity pilot at San Jose produced pass rates, which in three different courses ranged from 23%, 25%, in one case 50%.
Terrible.
These are terrible rates. I mean, this is lower than the brick and mortar version of the class. Can you imagine rolling out a new program and having only 23% of the students passing? It's really a disaster. And the key here also is that these are real living students who are in the words of the provost of San Jose, participating in a living laboratory.
Yeah.
For the beta testing of this technology. And that, I think, brings up important ethical questions.
Well, and the feedback that you show in the film, online feedback, I think was kind of touching. Students who say, this was terrible, I didn't. And what you get is that, and this is another theme that emerges in the film, it's not enough to just have access to something online. You need a human voice. You need engagement. You need connection. That's another, I think, really crucial point in the film.
Particularly for students who struggle with material.
Exactly.
And are in this MOOC to begin with because they failed out of the previous versions of the class, they need a teacher to give them guidance, to clarify even the smallest thing, or to even physically, literally, pat them on the back. And just that small sort of behavior or action of like patting someone on the back is what we see happening at Bunker Hill Community College, where there is a MOOC that's being used, but in a hybrid context, yeah. So that there's an in-class instructor and the students are watching lectures at home, but then they still go into class and participate in some kind of interaction with a human teacher.
Do you think this is where we're headed? That it's not one or the other. It's we're going to have to find a mix of the two.
You know, it's interesting. That's this notion of a hybrid future. It's the same conclusion that we came to with page one,
yeah.
In terms of, you know, blogs not being the only answer, online news and print not being some holy cow that should, you know, have to dominate forever, but a sort of hybrid of traditional journalism values and digital tools. And I think that model or paradigm it also can point the way for higher education, that digital tools can help traditional teaching do better, but they shouldn't be a substitute for it completely, especially when you're dealing with students who struggle.
It seems like because you see a number of what I'll call purists like Thrun, who says we don't need the brick and mortar stuff, we can do it online. And then the other perspective who say, no, this is not going to work. You can't. I think you're going to have to work. Purists are going to have to ditch some of those conventional ideas if we're going to make this work, it seems.
That's right. I think that a sort of orthodoxy on any side at this moment is not going to be helpful.
Yeah. Let me ask you one thing. Anya Kamenetz talks about is how we sort of stopped expanding this idea of the franchise of education being a public thing, and we sort of moved to it being this private idea, and access for the poor starts to go down, as you mentioned, graduation rates stop rising, and a Pell Grant used to be enough. And this is where we get to this question of how of the really the student loan industry, something we didn't get a chance to talk a lot about, but say something a little bit about that, because that is that $1 trillion figure is sort of the crisis figure we hear a lot of.
Absolutely. So cumulative student loan debt is now actually in excess of $1.2 trillion. And Anthony Carnevale, who is from Georgetown and studies the labor market and how educational institutions play into that, explains that if a student is going to graduate with more than $50,000 in debt, then they really need to pause and to think about whether it's worth it. So here we get to that crucial question, is college worth it? And the answer is, well, it depends. It depends on what you're studying and how much debt you're going into to study that, and then how much you're likely to make when you graduate, and thus whether you can carry those loan payments. So in most cases, $50,000 is sort of the threshold, and $100,000 is the point where you know that if you're graduating with that much, you're not going to be able to start a family or choose a career that you might love versus one that's, you know, just going to help you pay off loans. Student loan debt is really a moral issue at this point.
I want to play one final clip. This is Andrew DeBlanca from Columbia University. And because I want to get this question, I wonder where you ended up. Did you end up pessimistic about the process or optimistic? In this clip, DeBlanca is pretty optimistic.
The more campuses one visits, the more one discovers that the diversity of America's college students is mind-boggling. And everywhere I go, I meet students who give me hope for the future of our country. It's not like the apocalypticists and the prophets of doom aren't sometimes right, but do I believe that we are on a course toward extinction? No. And if I believed it, I wouldn't admit it to myself because it would be too unpleasant a thought.
Did you end up where he did in some way? Where did you end up in, after all of this?
Well, I think that Andy's sort of reference to extinction and teachers going away again taps into this existential threat that teachers have really felt in the last year or so with MOOCs and with the cynicism about education. And I agree with him. I do not think that college and universities as an idea in American culture are going to become extinct. But I do think that there's going to be disruption and that there might be some schools that ultimately are not able to make the transition.
Andrew Rossi. This film is called Ivory Tower. It's screening here at the Sundance Film Festival, 5:30 today at Park City, and again on Saturday at the Egyptian Theater in Park City. You can go to our website for all of the details, radiowest.kuer.org. Andrew Rossi, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We, of course, are broadcasting live today from the studios of KPCW in Park City. Our thanks to them, to Mario Hebe, to Kate Stone, and others. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.